Okay, so we have an exam on Wednesday, and there's a review session this evening in room 116 WLH. I think I've got that on the web. If not, I'll send it to you. So, nucleophilic substitution, what today's lecture will show you is that there's a lot of variety in it. And there are two points of view one can take in studying it. One is the how to use it in synthesis, right? And there's an awful lot of lore about that. And the other is, how do you know what the mechanism is? And you're not surprised that that's what I tend to focus on because of our interest in mechanistic and physical organic chemistry in this course. But you'll see a little bit of the variety in both here. So, we looked last semester already at this idea of E2 elimination or beta elimination, where you take things on adjacent carbons. That's why it's called beta, right? Okay, and we looked at this mechanism. So, how do you know whether these things are happening at the same time? That the OH minus takes away the hydrogen and breaks its bond at the same time the double bond is forming, at the same time the leaving group is leaving. So, one thing you can do is look at the influences on the rate. So, as you change the concentration of base, the rate of this reaction increases. Right? So that must mean that the attack occurs during the rate determining step or before it. If the OH minus came up and took the hydrogen after the rate limiting step, it couldn't influence the rate. Right? So it's either during or before. That you know from the concentration of the base. But the rate also depends on the leaving group. A better leaving group goes faster. Okay, so that must be leaving before or during the rate determining step. Otherwise, it wouldn't affect the rate. So the OH minus is involved either before or during, and the leaving of the leaving group is involved either before or during. Right? Now, there's another type of study you can make about rate, which is the influence of having an isotope of hydrogen. And this is a very informative thing, because that will have an effect only if it's breaking during the transition state, not if it's before. We mentioned this in passing before, but let me just show it to you again here. So we know that you have a certain vibrational energy for the CH bond and also for the OH bond. So you start with the CH bond, OH minus comes off, comes along, pulls it off, you have an OH bond. Now in both of these, there is a fairly strong bond. But when the hydrogen is halfway transferred, then it's just balanced between the two, and there's very little bonding. Okay? So you go from, at the start, there's a strong bond, at the end, there's a strong bond, but during the transfer, there's not a strong bond. Right? Now, we know from quantum mechanics last semester, from Erwin meets Goldilocks, that there's a minimum vibrational energy that something can have, and that it depends on how deep the potential is, right? So you start with a big zero-point energy, you end with a big zero-point energy, but while the hydrogen is being transferred, you don't have much zero-point energy. The minimum vibrational energy is very near the absolute minimum of the potential energy curve, right? Okay, and that's because this is so broad that the wave function spreads way out. Okay, now suppose we have to do the activation energy to get from this energy over the transition state and then to get to product. Okay. And now suppose we had deuterium instead. Instead of hydrogen, there's a deuterium. And we have to break it away. What's the difference? Being heavier, it sits down further in the valley. Right? So it doesn't have as much zero-point energy. It's closer to the bottom. In all cases, it's closer to the bottom. right? But the difference between deuterium and hydrogen is much bigger here than it is here, right? So the energy required to break the deuterium bond halfway, right, is larger than it is for hydrogen. On the other hand, if you go all the way to product, then you have a difference again. The product being the transfer of hydrogen to the base. So if the OH has completely taken the base away and is now bonded to it, then you have the same difference between hydrogen and deuterium, or almost the same, as you had at the beginning. What's really special is when the bond is half broken, and then they have the same energy. Okay? So if you find that the rate depends on whether you have hydrogen or deuterium, and is faster when you have hydrogen, then it must mean that in the rate-limiting step, you're in a situation like that. You can't have had the hydrogen transferred first and then the rate-limiting step, because then you would have been to here by the time the rate-limiting step occurs, and there's no difference or very little difference between hydrogen and deuterium anymore. So the only time when you see an influence on rate is when the hydrogen is the bond to hydrogen or deuterium is very, very weak at the rate-limiting step, at the transition state for the rate-limiting step. So although these first things only say that this happens before or during, right, this says that the CH bond is being broken during the transition state. Is that clear to people how that works? Or does it just seem puzzling? Yeah, Aviva?
So would you only use deuterium, or would you use both deuterium and hydrogen?
There are two ways to do it. You can take a sample that has hydrogen and a different sample that has deuterium and measure their two rates. And if you find hydrogen's faster than deuterium, you've got it. On the other hand, it might be that the temperature was a little higher when you did the hydrogen and deuterium, and they really should have had the same rate, right? But it was your experimental error that made the misapprehension, okay? So in that case, what's easier to do is to put both the hydrogen molecule and the deuterium molecule in there and run the reaction for a short period, and then see what the ratio of hydrogen to deuterium is in the remaining starting material. If they went at the same rate, you have the same ratio that you started with. But if hydrogen went faster than deuterium, then you have less hydrogen than deuterium in the starting material. So that's said to be doing it by competition rather than by independent measuring of the rates. That's a very handy way to do things. You can do it the same way by measuring the effect of a leaving group, right? You have molecules with two different leaving groups. You put them in there, do the reaction part way, and see what remains. Has one of them gone faster than the other? And that corrects then for a lot of errors you might have made in concentrations or temperature or whatever. Derek?
And so the difference between the activation and
yeah, it's the distance to go from starting material to transition state is bigger for deuterium than it is for hydrogen, right? Because there's a zero-point energy difference here, but there's not a zero-point energy there or difference or very small. But it's only when the transition state has this very unusual bonding, very weak bonding, that you can see that. If it's already mostly transferred, and you know, it can depend on just how much it's transferred at the transition state. The transition state, it could be very early, the transition state in which you haven't stretched the bond much yet. It could be very late where you've almost completely stretched the bond or broken it. Or it can be where it's halfway along. So you can see that you can measure how far along it's gone, because you only get this effect when it's about halfway along. Did you have a question?
Yeah. For the base and the leaving group?
For the which?
The base and the leaving group?
Yeah.
It happened before the rate determining step? Maybe it not affect?
No, because if you had a stronger base, you would have gotten a more stable... The thing when you pulled the proton off would be more stable, right, if you had a stronger base. That means you'd get more of that intermediate. If you had an initial fast reaction that gave the intermediate, and then a rate-limiting step, right? But that means you have more of the intermediate, right? So the rate will go faster. Or what you've profited by in energy is making this bond to the base, right? That happened in the first step, but it hasn't gone away when you get to the transition state. You still have that energetic advantage. Okay, so it just has to be before or during or before. Okay, and the same thing with the leaving group. Okay, so if KH is greater than KD, then you know that it had to happen during the rate determining transition state. Okay, now another tool you can use is stereochemistry. And the way I've drawn this, if I tip it up a little bit, the hydrogen's going to be here and the leaving group is opposite as I've drawn here. Although fluoride, as you know now, is a terrible leaving group. I just did it because it was easier to calculate in this case with fewer electrons. So anyhow, you have this. If you looked at it from this direction with your eyeball, it would look like this. It's the anti-conformation. Now, it could be that it would be in the syn conformation where the H is on top of the L when you look at it. They're parallel to one another. I mean, it could be any phase of rotation. It could be they could be gauche to one another, and the leaving group could be sticking out this way. Can anybody see a preference for syn or anti versus sticking out at right angles? Sharif?
Would it have a preference for anti, so it can come attack from one way and the group can be from the other?
So why? Why should you do that?
So that, because I think like how we talked about in the last lecture where the leaving group leaves from the opposite side.
Yeah, that's when you're attacking the same carbon. Right? And it's attacking sigma star, the backside of sigma star. And there are arguments made in this case that are of that general nature at all, but I think there are others that are more forceful. Yeah?
Would the anti be favored because the L group and the hydrogen then move the electron density away from the center?
That the L will take the electron density away. Pardon, say it again?
We had that instance where the two protons move the electron density away from the bond.
I can't hear very well, sorry.
We had that instance where the two protons move some of the electron density away from the bonding region between the two carbons.
Oh, yeah, I see. I remember what you mean. I hadn't thought of that here. That might be a factor. But I think the reason you don't want it to be at right angles is that then the orbitals you're generating don't overlap with one another. Notice here, this is a sigma star and this is a sigma star, and as we break this one and break this one, we have this new bond here. But this p orbital will overlap with this p orbital only if these are either opposite one another. As here, that is, this orbital will overlap this orbital, or this one will overlap the one behind, or it could happen in this case as well. So you aren't be able to get the double bond. You aren't able to profit from that. It'll be much higher in energy if you don't have them in the same plane. But they could be in the same plane, either anti or syn. Now, of course, an obvious factor is that we know that in the anti arrangement is staggered and syn is eclipsed. So that may be the only important explanation in choosing between these, that this is higher in energy being eclipsed. But there's another one in deciding which should be better, besides this one being more strained, which is that it turns out that anti-hybrids on adjacent carbons overlap a little better than syn ones do. So that may be a factor too. It's not hard to show, but I'm not going to take the time to do it now. Okay? But how can we test this experimentally, whether this bond is being formed in this from an anti-elimination geometry? The way to do it is to put substituents in. So if you put R groups on there, here, 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 and then If you go from the ante to the sin and rotate this group by 180 degrees, then here the R's are on the same face coming out toward us, but here one is in front and one is in back. Right? So as we remove H and L from this one, we see the two R groups will be on the same face of the double bond, same side of the double bond. It'll be cis. Right? But if we did it the other way, they would be trans to one another. So this is taken from the book. What they did was to put substituents on here, right, so that there would be handedness. And notice that this carbon is S in both cases, and the other carbon is R in this case, but S in this case. So these are two enantiomers, or two diastereomers of this compound that has a leaving group and a hydrogen to leave. Now, if the hydrogen and the leaving group leave from the same face from this one, then phenyl and H will be on the same side of the new double bond. But if they come opposite one another, H is opposite, anti to the tosylate, then the H and the phenyl will be opposite one another, or more relevantly for nomenclature, phenyl and methyl will be, the high priority groups will be Z together on the same side. Derek?
Well, is it possible that once you get those, that intermediary structure with a single bond between the two carbons, that there could be just rotation around that single bond?
But if there's an intermediary structure, You mean you're pulling these away and there's a single bond and then a double bond forms?
Yeah.
If that happened, you're absolutely right. Right? But if it formed at the same time that they're leaving, then there's not a chance to rotate. And that's in fact what this proves. Right? Because when you start with SR, you get only Z. So it had to go with an anti-elimination. But if you start with the SS, then you get only E. So this stereochemistry shows that the double bond is forming at the same time that the H is leaving, at the same time the leaving group is leaving. Okay, so it's anti-elimination and anti-stereochemistry. But it's not dogmatic. If you can't do it, then it is possible to go through this one. So, for example, if you have to remove either hydrogen or deuterium at the same time that the tosylate group is leaving here, the leaving group, to form this new double bond, you could, in principle, remove either D or H. Now, you might say D is bad to remove because it's sin. It would rather be anti-elimination. But in this case, it can't get anti. You can't twist to make this one opposite this one because of the way the carbons are being held here. Right? So if you can't do the anti-elimination, then there's nothing wrong with doing the sin elimination. Another way of looking at this is that the starting material is here is already eclipsed. You can't get away from that. The way all these carbons are bonded together holds these to be in the same plane. So it starts eclipsed. You don't have to pay any penalty for that. And then it's easy enough to pull them all off at once. But other things being equal, it would rather be anti. Okay, now, I forgot to animate this. There's also a process called beta elimination, and to show you this, I can't. Well, what I'm going to I'll fix this up and put it on the web for you so that you can go through it. But let me just show you at the end. It could be that the beta elimination has regiochemistry. That is, when you have the leaving group here and a base comes along, alkoxide, it could pull the hydrogen away either from this position or from this position. If it pulls away from this position, you get this double bond like this. And it could be either cis or trans. If you pull the way away from this hydrogen, then you generate a double bond at the end, and you get that one. So there are two possibilities. And it tends to be rather complicated, and people try to simplify it by giving names to the two processes. when it gives, when the major product is this one, it's called Hoffman elimination. And that's the same Hoffman that thought up alkane, alkene, alkyne, and so on. Okay, and the he studied elimination where the leaving group was an amine, so it starts with an ammonium salt. And when those things, when these things are big, it tends to go this way to give that one. On the other hand, a Russian named Zaitsev studied the more normal kinds of leaving groups like bromine, and found that in that case, the major component is the one that gives the more substituted double bond, and the minor one is the product that Hoffman would have gotten. So as you look here at different leaving groups, different alkenes, different halides here, you can see that it goes from being mostly Zaitsev, mostly giving the more substituted compound, to more Hoffman, more of the less substituted compound. So you can do a lot of arguing about why this is. One factor that's surely important in the Zaitsev case is that the product is more stable in this case when it's more substituted. And we've seen that before, that you have sp squared carbons making bonds to carbons, whereas the terminal one makes two bonds to hydrogen. So you're not making as efficient a use of the bonding potential of the sp2 carbons. Yeah. It's not the question of energy match. It's just that the overlap, you get better overlap with sp squared. But there's no reason to think that the increase would have to be exactly the same for bonding from sp squared to hydrogen and bonding to sp squared to carbon. And what one learns from this is that it's better for carbon. Right. So, at any rate, the Zaitsev tends to give the more stable compound, and Hoffman, because of things running into one another in the transition stage, when you have a big leaving group here, then it's a little bit crowded if you also have to get the base at this, and less crowded if you go for the hydrogen out there. So there's been a lots and lots of discussion of that, and I don't think we have to spend a lot of time on it. But this is just several figures from the book that I put together there. Now there's also the question of whether you get E2 or Aviva.
On the last slide, it says that F is Hoffman preferred. Why would it be Hoffman preferred if it's the smallest?
It depends on just where the transition state is. To what extent the fluorine is gone away. We said that our evidence is that all these things are happening at the same time. Okay? Fine. But that doesn't mean they've all happened to exactly the same extent at the same time. Right? If it's a bad leaving group, you probably pull more of the hydrogen away before the leaving group completely breaks. And vice versa. If it's a very good leaving group and the base isn't very strong, then the leaving group will have more than halfway left before the hydrogen gets halfway broken away. So you can shift back and forth that way, and that's probably the difference, the source of the difference here. Now, the same similar kinds of factors have to do with whether you do SN2 or E2, whether you do a substitution or elimination. And we've already seen that in the case of T-butyl, that SN2 is very difficult to do in T-butyl because you have those three methyl groups trying to get in behind and get overlap with sigma star is very bad. Right? But it's easy to take off a hydrogen that's on one of the methyl groups and have the leaving group leave. So there's a case where steric effects are very important in deciding between these. But it also has to do with base strength, because as we saw last time when we talked about the base, whether we could correlate how tightly something bonds to a hydrogen with how tightly it bonds to carbon in the transition state, that is, whether basicity and nucleophilicity would run right in parallel, we saw that that was not true. There were some things that were good at being bases compared to how good they were at attacking carbons, and some vice versa. Right? So the strength of the base is going to be especially important when you're doing the elimination, pulling the hydrogen off. the proton, but the strength of attacking the carbon is what's important for SN2. So that for any particular HOMO, whether it's better as a base or better as a nucleophile, is important in determining this ratio, and you can read about that in 7.9. And then 7.10 is about using SN2 reactions to make a lot of new compounds. And this is a little like the slide we showed when we introduced nucleophilic substitution. That there are lots of different nucleophiles you can use to get many different kinds of products. And we'll just look at a couple of them here. Some of them are discussed in this section. One of the most important ones is making ethers. And so we have an SN2 reaction that makes an ether here. And this is... why is that drawn twice? It's the same thing, isn't it? Anyhow, it's certainly a general case. It can happen all the time. I took this right out of the book, I thought. Anyhow, this is, as we mentioned before, is called the Williamson ether synthesis and was discovered by Williamson in 1850, roughly. And here's a specific example that's given in the book done in DMSO solvent. And it's much more believable when you see things like this, even if it's written twice. It's more believable when you see 53%. Right, then you know they're talking about something that somebody actually studied. Okay, but so here's such a case where the oxygen displaces bromide, makes that ether in 53% yield. Now, where do you get alkoxides? Well, you could imagine just putting hydroxide into an alcohol and pulling the proton off. But that's not a good way to do it because the equilibrium constant is 50-50 and you have the hydroxide there that could also be acting as a nucleophile and getting an alcohol instead of ether. So it's better to get all alkoxide, and you can do that by having hydride as a very strong base. A nice thing about that is when it pulls the proton on to off to generate the alkoxide, the byproduct is hydrogen, so it just goes away. Similarly, you can react with an alkali metal like sodium, which will transfer electrons as well and give the alkoxide and hydrogen gas. So it's ways like that ultimately that these nucleophiles are made for such a synthesis. Now, Williamson synthesis doesn't always work. For example, if you wanted to make methyl T-butyl ether, you might imagine doing it by having methoxide attacking T-butyl iodide. But that won't work because you don't do an SN2 reaction at a T-butyl center. So are you out of luck? What can you do instead? You change which R group is the alkoxide and which R group is being attacked as the substrate, right? So instead of doing that, you use the T-butoxide as the nucleophile, and now the methyl group is being attacked, and that's easy to do in SN2. So you can get a good yield of it one way and not the other. So often, there'll be two different ways to get a product, and there's a choice to be made in favor of one of them. And of course, you can't make di-T-butyl ether that way because you'd have to be using the T-butyl iodide as being attacked. So you do it a different way. You use an SN1 reaction rather than an SN2 reaction. And here's a really neat variant of the Williamson ether synthesis where the alkoxide is in the same molecule with the leaving group. Now, these things have to be on opposite faces so they can be anti to one another. But now you can use alkoxide because it will pull this off, so you can get the O minus here. But now you have in the solution, you have both this O minus and other hydroxides floating around. But it's no contest. It's much easier for this O minus to attack the adjacent carbon than for some other random O minus to find it. Right, so this one has a big advantage. It can do an SN2 type reaction, displace the chloride, and get this three-membered ring ether, which is called an oxirane formally, or informally an epoxide. And you see it's generated here in 73% yield. Now, why do you want epoxides? It turns what might be special about an epoxide in terms of energy? Right?
Very high HOMO.
Why would it have a high HOMO? Well, yeah, but any ether has that, right? That doesn't make this one special. Christine? It's very strained. It's high in energy. And that means it's going to be easily attacked. That is, that this oxygen is going to be a good leaving group. Okay? So you can bring other nucleophiles in and attack and open this thing. Most ethers, remember, you can't, it's not a good leaving group. Remember, you could use HBr to protonate it, and then Br, a good nucleophile, might do it. But you can do it in this case with many nucleophiles are able to attack this one because it's strained. So then you can have a nucleophile attack this carbon and get an alcohol. And there are many cases we'll see later on where you do that. In fact, the formation of crown ethers depends on that reaction. Okay, and the simpler case where you don't have the rest of the stuff but just two carbons and oxygen is called ethylene oxide. And that's a great source of adding two carbons to a nucleophile because you have the two carbons bridged by oxygen. A nucleophile comes in and attacks one, the oxygen leaves. So this nucleophile is now attacked to this carbon and also attached to this carbon and the second carbon. There are two carbons in a row. Right, so you can add two carbons to a nucleophile with ethylene oxide. That's a handy SN2 reaction. And one of the important things to do that with is to use carbon as the nucleophile, either in acetylene or cyanide. So now you can make new carbon-carbon bonds. You know, mostly these nucleophiles are things that have unshared pairs, not carbon. So you can make different functional groups, but you can't change the carbon skeleton of a molecule in that way. But if you use a carbon nucleophile, then you can do it. So acetylide can be formed by amid. We talked about the pKa's of this earlier. You can see that that's practical. And also I put on this slide another nucleophile, ammonia. So ammonia can do an SN2 reaction. Right, but the product can also be a nucleophile in an SN2 reaction, and the product of that can be a nucleophile in the SN2 reaction to give this, and the product of that can be an SN can do the product of this one can do it too. So you can get four alkyl groups on the ammonia, but you can't get any more because you've run out of unshared pairs now. Okay, or hydrogens that can be lost. Okay. Of course, you can't do it when the alkyl group is tertiary here because of you can't do SN2 at the tertiary center. So this is neat if you want to put four alkyl groups on, right? But suppose you want just one. What do you do? Well, then, of course, you can use an enormous amount of ammonia so that it's very unlikely that any given ammonia would find two different alkyl groups, right? You have a big excess of ammonia. Or you can use a big excess of the alkylating agent and go all the way to the end. But tricks to stop part way are of great interest, and we'll talk about those later on when we talk more about nitrogen chemistry. Now, if we look at the rate of this reaction for different R groups, you see something that's interesting. Okay. Now, let's be quite specific about it. It's reaction with sodium hydroxide in ethanol water at 55 degrees. And here is the rate constant for forming HOR in units of per minute, -2. So it takes about 100 minutes. You know, a half-life for the reaction is of the order of 100 minutes. For methyl, okay. For ethyl, it's 10 times slower, and that's what you expect. It's more crowded to do the SN2 reaction. For isopropyl, it's more crowded still, at another order of magnitude slower, right? That again makes sense. It's what we've talked about before. But T-butyl is up there when you do the reaction under these conditions. That doesn't make sense at all. It should be down on the floor someplace. T-butyl doesn't do this kind of reaction we've been saying to attack T-butyl bromide. Okay? So what's going on? Okay? This happens with 0.01 molar sodium hydroxide. That's the way it's done. But if you change the concentration of sodium hydroxide and see how the rate changes, if you lower the concentration, the rate goes down, you get slower. If you raise the concentration, the rate goes up. That's fine. But it doesn't happen much here, not nearly as dramatically as here, and it doesn't happen at all there. The rate of formation is. So there's a different reaction going on. The base isn't pulling the proton off in the rate determining step. Remember, the reason we knew the mechanism for these things was because of the dependence on hydroxide. So the second order rate constant for SN2 reaction is like this. Right? That's the rate constant. And this, if you have a hundredth molar, then it's two orders of magnitude slower because you multiply by the concentration to get the rate. Okay? But this is a first order reaction. It doesn't depend on that. It's in fact accelerated by crowding, and it goes by way of first losing the leaving group, right, to get the T-butyl cation. And the T-butyl cation is unusually stable, which is why this is so. And it's operating in a polar solvent, which makes it easy to make the cation. Now, what happens in the isopropyl case? The isopropyl case actually has this rate, the blue one, for the first order reaction. Formation of the cation first as an intermediate. And it's just a little bit faster than that because there's a little bit of the second order rate process going on. In other words, both things are happening with that. So this is the SN1 reaction. It depends only on it doesn't depend on the nucleophile. This was all figured out by Hughes and Ingold in London in the 1930s. And this rate, of course, is very fast. It's about take a minute. So they did it at lower temperature and figured out what it would be at this temperature. Okay? And that's only to give HOR. There's another reaction going on in which you are eliminating, pulling a proton away in the E2 reaction that we just discussed about. And you can see that because it increases when you increase the rate. And in fact, at this, under these conditions here, 19% of the product is elimination, not substitution. Okay? Now, the SN1 and E1, notice an interesting feature is that the product is determined after the rate is determined by competition for a short-lived cation. So you have this, it ionizes to give the cation, and now the cation can either add the nucleophile, cyanide in this case, or the cyanide can pull off a proton and generate the alkene, or water can act as the nucleophile and attack this. Right? But notice here that the rate is determined by the rate of forming the cation, because once formed, it never goes back to the starting material. It rapidly goes to product. But which product? Right? That'll depend on which of these nucleophiles is better. Right? So as you put more cyanide in, you'll get more cyanide product, but the rate does not increase, the rate of disappearance of the starting material, because it's SN1, not SN2. So this separation of product determination and rate determination is a way that you know that you have, is another way that you know you have SN1. And another way to know you have this cation intermediate is that you can get funny products. For example, suppose you started with neopentyl iodide, right? If you did an SN2 reaction, you'd get the OH attached to the same carbon. Fine. But if you treat this with silver nitrate, silver being able to pull off iodide, right? So you generate a cation intermediate. So this is going to be SN1. Right? Then you get a really funny thing, because not only is the OH attached to a different carbon, to this carbon, but the nature of the carbon bonding has changed. Here, there were four carbons each attached to a central carbon, but that's not true here. There are three carbons attached to the central carbon, and the carbon that was here is now attached to a different carbon. There's been a rearrangement. Now, how does that rearrangement happen? This way, you get, it could be one of two ways actually. You generate the cation, but then these electrons that are involved in the bond overlap with the low LUMO here. So the method, so these, it's like the dimerization of BH3, where a vacant orbital is able to stabilize the electrons in a bond and make the, and those electrons then hold three atoms together. These three, so it could be cyclic. But that could just be a transition state on the way to going all the way over. Now, why would you want to go all the way over? To get a more stable tertiary cation as compared to the primary cation. In fact, it might be so difficult to make the primary cation that these electrons are required as a sort of nucleophile to help the iodide leave, and then you go directly to the rearranged. But one way or the other, you get a rearranged product, and it's because you went through a cation intermediate that can rearrange. So that shows that it's an SN1 process, that you had a cation, because if you didn't have a cation, you couldn't get these bonds moving around. Right? An interesting stereochemical feature of SN1 is that if you go to a planar cation intermediate, you could attack from either side. So ideally, you'd expect the product to be 50-50, to be racemic. But in fact, that's normally not the case. For example, in this case, it's nearly racemic, but there's more of the stuff inversion. That doesn't mean it's SN2. What happens is that as you form the cation by breaking off the leaving group, obviously the leaving group is here, right? The cation is very reactive. It's easier to react at this face where there's nothing on it than at this face where the leaving group is sitting there. You have to wait a little while for the leaving group to get away before you can attack 50-50. So this shows the extent to which the pair of ions has held together. That is, you generated a cation and an anion intermediate, but they attract one another even if they're not bonding and tend to be like that. Right? But if you wait long enough, they can get away from one another or rotate relative to one another so that then you can attack either face. Sharif?
Does that mean that if you have a better leaving group, in that it's more stable, you have...
Yeah, no, in a way, but the leaving group is going to be an anion, whatever the, or most leaving groups are anions, and there's not bonding anymore. So whether the anion is stable or not, you don't care. Whether the original bond was strong or weak, you don't care. You've got this, right? And now it's getting away has nothing to do with how strong the bond is or how stable the anion is. It's just how it moves. Now, how can you tell whether it's E1 or E2 when you get an elimination to give an alkene? Of course, you can use the definition E1 or E2 and see whether the rate depends on OH minus. But another way is to use the kinetic isotope effect to see whether the hydrogen is being transferred in the rate limiting step. So that's using this technique we talked about at the beginning. You can discriminate between E1 and E2. We just have a few minutes here. Let me roar through something else. I'll just say a word about this. So you get very drastic ratios in this. This obviously can't get elimination. You get only substitution, so it's 100% substitution. This can't do the substitution. It does the E2 elimination, so you get a big ratio. But more often, it's things where you don't get such a drastic ratio. Now, there are different perspectives on drastic ratios. From a synthetic organic chemist, it's great to get 100% yield of something, right? It's a reliable yield. But for a physical organic chemist, the reason it's so good to have is that the EA, the activation energy difference, is very definitive. And then you can get an unambiguous interpretation of cause if you have a really big effect. For example, that the steric retardation of SN2 was big effect, and we could see that T-butyl doesn't even work. Or in an SN1 reaction, you got a 10 to the 5th acceleration of how fast it goes. Really good evidence for a cation intermediate. So synthetic chemists like drastic yields because they're reliable synthetic tools, physical organic chemists because they give unambiguous interpretations. Now, what if you get about a 50-50 mixture of two products? Right, the synthetic organic chemist, that's deadly, because if you were doing a synthesis that involved 12 successive steps and got a 50% yield on each one, you'd get a 0.02% yield at the end of the day. That's disastrous. But you might be able to optimize at change conditions to make these yields better. But a physical organic chemist likes that as a valuable borderline reference. When something is delicately balanced, then you can measure small effects. You change the nucleophile a little bit, change the concentration, change the solvent, and see which way it goes. If it already all went all one way, there wouldn't be anything to see. Right, so carefully balanced things allow sensitive tests of subtle influences like isotope effects. Now, I was going to close with a lesson from E2 elimination. The punchline I can get to quickly, but we won't have time to spend going over the beginnings. It had to do with Joe David Fine, who was an undergraduate in the class of 1972. He wanted to study this molecule to answer an interesting question about whether the rate-limiting step could be motion rather than bond breaking. Okay, because you can send UV light in and get these two radicals, and you could imagine those two carbons coming together, but that's not what happens. What happens is that you get elimination instead of substitution, so to say. It's a radical reaction. It's not these SN1 kind of things. Now, the nitrogen was in the way of those because it was generated between those, but you could imagine the nitrogen to rotate together with that deuterated T-butyl group like this, and then the deuterium is close enough that you can do a radical type elimination where you do that, take off the deuterium and make a double bond, and you get that product. On the other hand, it could have been, and that's called disproportionation, it's one of the mechanisms of termination of a radical chain for radicals to get together. On the other hand, it could have been the hydrogen-containing radical that rotated together with the nitrogen to reach that geometry on the lower right, and then you could shift the hydrogen atom. So you'd get different products, and you could then measure these products and see which one happened. If the motion was rate-limiting, if breaking the bond was rate-limiting, if it was being transferred in the rate-determining step, then hydrogen should be transferred faster than deuterium, and you should get more of the stuff on the bottom than on the top. But if the rate-limiting step was the rotation, right, and then the hydrogen or deuterium transfer that was in position happened rapidly after that, then there wouldn't be an isotope effect, because you're not breaking a bond in the transition state. Okay, so Joe David needed this compound for his question. So how do you get it? Well, you could get it from this. And let's not go into that too much, except to say maybe he could do it by a nucleophilic substitution. Have this amine, unshared pair, displace chloride here and get that. So is that a good way to do this? What? No, you can't do SN2 right at that. And, in fact, it's much easier to do elimination than to do substitution, so the product is going to be this. So forget that. So Joe David went to the literature and found this from the University of Michigan about how to prepare this compound. And we won't go through this, except they said that they looked at a lot of synthetic methods that they gave negligible yields. So they found a fancy method, which involved making Grignard reagents. Have you done that yet in lab? Grignard? Those can be hard, especially with T-butyl, which they had to do here. So let's not go into this, because this is stuff we're going to be discussing later. Okay. So Joe David tried it, right? He tried from April through October. He worked the whole summer, and he never got any of the product. And he got very depressed. And finally, in October, he telephoned the professor at Michigan whose name was on this paper, and this is his note from that telephone call. Most importantly, he stressed that his published method will not give the desired product. Instead, the T-butyl group is lost. They haven't ever been able to reproduce this student's results or make any more. Although he feels that hydrolysis in the desired manner is possible if the hydrolysis is killed very rapidly, he said, play around with it. Now, Joe David had been playing around from April through October on this thing that was in the literature and presumably reliable, right? So he wrote another note down beneath this. He said, for the sake of public courtesy and sophistication, I will reserve my own comments on this subject. Okay, so Joe David did other things, and then he became he's a professor of dermatology at Vanderbilt now, and his son has graduated from Yale. But I want to show you one interesting thing. That summer after Joe David left, I talked to Professor Nelson from the University of Wisconsin about our difficulty in making this. And he said, if you do this, that's absolutely a big problem. 95% elimination. But this is a gas that just goes away. Right? You get 5% of that. And this stuff down here, it is easily purified by crystallization, and the starting material is fantastically cheap. So you get 5%. When you need a compound, percent yield isn't everything. Rather than working from April through October, in 2 days, we took this really cheap stuff and made 10 grams of that, which was all we needed. Right? So there's a happy ending. Joe David Fine's successor found that, in fact, there was no isotope effect. So indeed, the rotation was rate limiting. And Joe David's done fine, too. Okay, so that's the end. Thanks for staying a few minutes. The review is I can't remember whether it was 8 to... Is it 8 to 10 or 7 to 9? It's 7 to 9, and it's in room 116 WLH.
Are there...
Can't hear.
On Wednesday, are there two different testing sessions?
Are there two different... Oh, yeah. Yeah, there'll be an early session down in the other room, as usual. Can't hear that.
The review session is from 7 to 9 tonight?
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Are you showing...
Pardon me?
So you're taking over the...
Yeah, I'll do the review session tonight. And then you and Eugene can figure out how you can do something tomorrow and email the students about when you're available. Have you done that already?
Well, we've signed up for a room, but we haven't got one assigned yet.
Well, to tell the email the students about when you'll be available so they can plan the room. You can come later.
Right.
So this is just an email separate question that I asked, but I was just like... methyl isopropyl T-butyl as methyl.
Just a second, let me turn this off here.
I got a report.